say some things about the Hamiltonian constraint and quantum cosmology, but at a less technical level than last time, and then focus our discussion on conceptual and philosophical issues, and broaden back out and present the context for the issues of time in cosmology and quantum cosmology. So I also would like this, so this is a kind of transition lecture, and I would also like it to be more focused on discussion. So I hope there'll be more discussion. I hope also you all out at Western will contribute more. Okay, and I'll do my best here. So let me review the basic issue that leads to the puzzle of time. The basic issue is that we start with some Lagrangian. So this could be, this is true for the Barber-Bertotti model and also true of general relativity. We have a phase space, so we have some initial, quote, kinematical variables which define a kinematical phase space. And I'll just call them Qs and Ts. And they have some Poisson brackets like this. And then we have some first class constraints. And these, so these generically we say are C of Q and T equal to zero. There's a set of them, so I'll have an index I, and their simultaneous solution defines a surface called the constraint surface. And we impose the constraints in the evolution, and not only do, so that we start at a point on the constraint surface, and we demand that evolution continue in the constraint surface, so all the trajectories stay in the constraint surface. And that gives us first class, or sometimes what I call business class constraints. The point being that it's consistent to impose all the constraints and have the evolution stay in the constraint surface. And the Hamiltonian is a linear combination of constraints times Lagrange multipliers, which is to say that the Hamiltonian on the constraint surface is zero. This is the first key feature which is strange or which is unusual about the dynamics. And we understood, we didn't give a general proof, but we gave several examples in which the vanishing of the Hamiltonian on the constraint surface was a consequence of time reparameterization invariance. So that there's no preferred time in the dynamics. Now, in a particular case, gravitational case, and given my knee, I'm not going to be leaping for blackboard, so we'll deal with what we have. By the way, it's clear that what Eric has been doing, those of you who are also following Eric Poisson's lectures, is talking about general relativity in the initial data formulation or Hamiltonian formulation related to the metric variables or the old variables. They're sometimes called the ADM variables. So it's a nice complement to what we're doing. So the picture is that there's a space-time when you have a solution of the constraints, and the space-time is described by saying, by putting on some coordinate, some function which gives a time coordinate, and by having level surfaces, t equals 0, t equals 1, t equals constant is a space-like surface we can call sigma of t, and we're assuming here it's compact with no boundary. And so the space-time is of the form of this compact three-dimensional surface cross time. And among the constraints, there are a class V of V that generate diffeomorphisms of the spatial surface. And that's what we talked about last time. And in my opinion, loop quantum gravity has various open issues, but the big result or the big strength of loop quantum gravity is the reduction of the problem of solving this quantum mechanically, and I'll come to what that means in a minute, but you know, in a way that is exact and clean, that is reducing the problem of finding the spatially diffeomorphism in variant states to a problem of classifying embeddings of certain graphs in a three-dimensional space. There is also the Gauss's law constraint that generates the local SU2 gauge invariance of the connection formalism. And then there's the Hamiltonian constraint. And the idea of the Hamiltonian constraint is that that integrated against the function n called the lapse, so integral on the free surface n against the lapse, the lapse can be, this tells, this generates motion of the time coordinate, hence a time reparametrization variance, but a manifold, a three-dimensional manifold versus a time reparametrization variance, where depending on the value of n, you push the surface forward an amount proportional to n. And in particular, you're allowed to have what's called bubble evolution, the local evolution where you just have n non-zero in some small compact region, and then you're just computing the change in the variables from this surface to this surface here. Those changes are generated by the Hamiltonian constraint. The Hamiltonian constraint, therefore, has the dynamics in it because it tells you how the fields change as you evolve under what becomes the time in the space-time. That is, if you think of time in the space-time as defined by the light cones, which are there after you have a solution, then this is telling you how to go in the directions, how the variables evolve on the space-time in a solution in a way which is timeless. And notice that this is implicit because you only know what is a time-like versus a space-like direction when you have the metric. You only have the metric when you have a solution to the classical equations of motion. And so the relationship between the evolution given by the Hamiltonian constraint and what's on the solution called time only makes sense solution by solution. In a different solution, there will be different metrics, and the notion of what space-like and time-like locally will be different. Okay, so are there any questions about, this is the sort of picture, classically, that that we're working with. And the idea and the results are that either in the ADM variables or in the Ashtakar variables, or related variables to the Ashtakar-Barbera variables, you start with some initial data that satisfies the constraints, you evolve, and you make a space-time which is a solution of Einstein's equations, and therefore defines a local causal structure when you have a solution. Okay. And to do that, it happens to be the case, and I'll just write it down, that in the Ashtakar variables, the local form of C has the form of epsilon ijk F, A, B, K, E, A, I, E, B, J, minus 2 times the cosmological constant times the determinant
of E.
Where E is, E in some of the previous lectures, E is the densitized electric field, which I also call pi in previous lectures. Okay, and an important thing, an important formal character is that the diffeomorphism constraints and the gauge constraints are linear in momentum. And this is quadratic in momentum. Now, just to outline that difference, but let me ask if there are any questions, because this is the classical structure that we want to quantize. And just to say what I said, the most important thing is that there's not a notion of time in the theory before the theory is solved. That is, if by time we mean time as it would be defined within a space-time, defined by the causal structure, defined by the ordering of events, and any other way you want is tied to the causal structure. For example, defining time thermodynamically, any way you would define time in a space-time doesn't exist in any obvious way on the constraint surface. What happens on the constraint surface is there are solutions. You start with some initial data, and there are solutions which, when you evolve them classically by the first order differential equations, stay on the constraint surface and generate a space-time which is a solution to the Einstein equation on which there is a standard notion of time. That is the standard general relativistic notion of time. But there is not necessarily, there is a parameter along the trajectory. But as in the case of the Barber-Bertotti model, the actual solution to the Einstein equation is independent of that parameterization. You could have chosen a different parameter and evolved, that is, chosen different n functions here, and you get the same solution to Einstein's equations, just with different slices. So there is a parameter in the infinite dimensional phase space by which you evolve, but that is not related to anything that you would call a notion of time in the space-time. It's not observable, and there's an infinite dimensional ambiguity as to what it is. So what is, quote, time there is nothing to do with what is time here. So this is the classical setup. And let me just say one more thing about that. As a result of that, there are actually an infinite dimensional set of trajectories in the configuration space, I'm sorry, in the phase space, that all evolve the same initial data and just differ by different values of the function n by which you're doing the evolution and pushing things forward. So you actually have an infinite dimensional bundle of trajectories in the constraint surface, which all correspond to one space-time. They correspond, in fact, to just different ways of defining the time coordinate on the space-time. And again, let me emphasize, the time coordinate is not an observable. It's just some auxiliary mathematical device we use in order to construct solutions of the Einstein equations by integration of these differential equations. So that's the context where we are classically. Okay. Now, as we get into discussion, there are two attitudes we could take to what we have so far. Okay. Roughly speaking, we can take the attitude that time in general relativity is unproblematic or, you know, is problematic. And let's distinguish that, because let's not get confused when we introduce issues coming from the quantization. Okay. I will come later today to discuss various things in classical general relativity that may be problematic, but let me globally suggest that we at least be clear about this in our discussions and our thinking. And globally, I would recommend starting with the point of view that time and general relativity is unproblematic, that is, given a solution of the Einstein equation, you can use the equivalence principle to always pick out local inertial frames. Because of that, there's a causal structure, which is dynamically determined by the evolution of the fields. And that causal structure is the notion of time in general relativity, or most of the notion of time in general relativity. There are certainly things that are hard to do if you do them from the wrong point of view in general relativity. So for example, if I want to know what's an observable, this is worth taking a minute over. In classical GR, one ready answer is that it's a function of the fields on the manifold, the connection, the gate field, the metric, any matter field, which is invariant under space-time diffeomorphism. So one proposal is that an observable is some function of the space-time metric, the connection, other fields, which is space-time, well, just to say it a little bit formally, which is invariant under the elements of the diffeomorphism group of the whole four-dimensional manifold. So that means that among the things which are not diffeomorphism invariant and are not observables are coordinates, the values of fields at some point pointed to by coordinates, because diffeomorphisms move the points around, etc. But there are plenty of things which are space-time diffeomorphism invariant. Supposing that I'll give two kinds of examples. So supposing that I take a photograph of the night sky as it is tonight, and Google is apparently sponsoring some telescope that's going to sort of take a photograph of the entire night sky up to some resolution every three nights. Okay. So if we want a resolution of three nights, let's say that's good enough. So this is called Google Universe. Okay, so it's a really, it's a sphere with up to, I forget what magnitude, but way past visual, it's a picture of the universe over three nights. Okay, now, let me make a definition. Let me say that a space-time with the matter in it is, and this is not my definition, so a space-time with matter, solutions to the Einstein's equations or not, is Leibnizian if Google Maps taken from any two space-time events are distinct. That is, I survey the backward light cone, what I'm doing is I'm taking a picture of the backward light cone at some event every 3 nights. Right? And the first claim is that night to night they'll be distinct. If they go out, if they see the planets, if they see variable stars, which they do. Okay? And a more interesting claim is that there'll be nowhere else in the universe that has to the level of precision that is the amount of gigabytes in one of those files that has precisely the same sky. Okay. And if we live in such a world, so first I'm giving the definition. Okay, and of course the definition comes from Julian Barber. He didn't know about Google Universe, but he made a similar definition. So first there's a physical hypothesis, which one can argue about, you know, our universe is Lyapunian. And you have to make an argument for that. Let me skip the argument, but I think you can make the argument. The universe is not so big that if you just use the position of the galaxies within 100 megaparsecs, that is not pretty unique. Because if you ask for the distribution on the sky of the galaxies within 100 megaparsecs, it makes a pattern. And you look at that pattern and you have to make an argument, and we discussed these kinds of things some time ago, and I apologize, I'm not prepared to make it, but you can make an argument of the form of the universe is not so big that the amount of data here is going to be reproduced if you ask the right question, the right combination of, you know, what are the planets in the solar system you're in look like, what are the stars within 100 light years look like, what are the galaxies within 100 megaparsecs look like. And particularly because our universe is evolving in time, what we have very good evidence for is that coarse grain to some time scale, times are different. That is, and this is actually a very significant fact about our universe, which is, you know, is a consequence of the Big Bang cosmology, which is that, you know, we could send one of these Google Universe files, we could put it in a, you know, a rock, embedded in a spaceship or a space capsule, and launch it off outside the solar system so that it's found by some other intelligence any amount of time, you know, from, you know, 3 weeks to 300 billion years into the future. And if they're advanced enough to understand what they found, they will be able to figure out what time, when it was sent, as well as if they really are good astronomers, where it was sent from. Okay, so let's suppose that that's true. Then there's a whole lot of observables of the form of go to some particular Google map. You know, Google map equals something, and measure something else. Say the, you know, measure R A B C D, R A B C D, some particular curvature scalar. Okay. Now, almost every call to a particular Google map will not result in anything, because almost every plausible description of the sky is not actually realized in our universe. But when it is realized, it will determine a location in space-time uniquely. That's the hypothesis. And then you can measure something else there. And in the construction of this, it's clearly diffeomorphism then. Okay, so that's one example. Another older example is define four generic, well, that word is not going to play any role in that sentence. we find four scalar functions of the field. So, you know, phi 1 might be what I just had there, RABCD, RABCD. Phi 2 might be the same thing for the electromagnetic field. Phi 3 might be some combination, RABCD, FAB, FCD, et cetera. I guess since I said there were only four, I might as well. Phi 4 is the temperature of the CMB. And then the, again, a hypothesis, okay, these or some similar four functions coordinatize the space-time manifold, the manifold and the metric. And again, this is for a particular solution of Einstein's equation. Okay. And if that's true, then you can consider anything else of interest, say psi bar psi, you know, for the quarks at the point given by phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and phi 4. And the idea is in a universe which is sufficiently interesting, sufficiently not a homogeneous isotropic solution, you will be able to find functions of the fields which uniquely specify some event in the history of your solution to Einstein's equation, and then you measure something else there, anything else. Okay, these were, I don't know who first discussed this, so this is sort of Julian Barber's kind of proposal, and I don't know that Julian was the first to discuss it, but he did so. This, to my knowledge, was first, kind of thing was first discussed by Peter Bergman and collaborators. Okay, so tell me if I haven't convinced you that there are observables in general relativity. As there are meaningful physical questions that can be asked about your solution of Einstein's equations that correspond to things that we could measure. Indeed, they correspond to things that we do measure. I mean, you know, so for example, an observable we certainly do measure is use Google Maps to say we're talking about here and now, and then we show you a snapshot of the cosmic microwave background. Because a snapshot of the cosmic microwave background will change in time. It hopefully does not change too much in space as you move around the universe, but nonetheless, it's an observable. It makes sense. And cosmologists study that. And by the way, there is a rumor that the WMAP five-year data is going to be published in the next few days. And it is the rumor, the contents of the rumor is that there's a cosmology workshop here starting, I believe, Thursday. And it may even be that the first talk on the WMAP five-year data and how the non-Gaussianity in it really rules out inflation, single field inflation, will be discussed at this workshop. Okay. And you didn't hear it from me. Okay. So general relativity has a notion of time, which I argue is sufficient. We can come back again to later to criticize it, but I think let's take it as sufficient for the time being. And general relativity has observables. Okay. Now, let me say two things which are very worrying. One of which is that in order to make contact with quantum mechanics, we formulated general relativity as a constrained Hamiltonian system that is in the language of this constrained surface in these constraints. Notice that it's a very long way from this structure to the causal structure. That is, supposing I give you, you know, the initial data, supposing I give you the A's and the E's, which correspond to some surface T equals zero, okay, on the constraint surface, so they solve the constraints. Okay. And now I ask you to work out the light cone structure of that space-time in the future. What are you going to do? It's a long way. You're going to solve, you're going to choose some ends, you're going to generate a solution to the Einstein equations, then you're going to start to ask questions about that solution to the Einstein equations. There's not going to be, they're not going to be questions which are easily related to A and E. To get them, they're going to be questions which are related to A of T and E of T, which are the values on future surfaces, where what those surfaces are depend on the N that you choose here. There's a lot of highly gauge-dependent information in there, which surfaces are used to evolve. Okay. And I mean, if I give you initial data for Friedman, Robertson, Walker, in some sense, you can recognize it as Friedman, Robertson, Walker. You can evolve it, and you can think you're doing physics. But that's only one highly symmetric solution. Okay. So the stuff related, the physical interpretation of general relativity of a Lorentzian spacetime, which is a solution of Einstein's equations in terms of time and causal structure, is a long way from the data that we're using to connect it to quantum theory. Okay. Even worse is take one of these diffeomorphism, space-time diffeomorphism invariant functions, okay, which tell me about what the past light cone of some observer on some planet Earth is going to be here, you know, 14 billion years after the initial data, okay, and write an explicit, you know, Google Earth observable, let me call it Google Earth observable, as a function of E and A on the T equals zero surface. Right? You're not, that's not an easy thing to do. The point is that by virtue of the fact that what's observable is space-time diffeomorphism invariant, first of all, there's a huge ambiguity of gauge in doing this, which has to all wash out in the end. Secondly, okay, all of these observables are relational. And I haven't given my big relational speech yet, and I'm expecting when I give it, Harvey and other people will tear me apart. But there is a sense in which these observables are very implicit as functions of the field. They're very, you know, it's a question of what is the value of some degree of freedom at values, at events specified by values of other degrees of freedom. And so they're about relationships between degrees of freedom. They're about correlations between degrees of freedom. And they're therefore going to be very complicated functions of the initial data. And several issues come in here. One of them, is you know, if general relativity has aspects or sectors which are chaotic, there could be an enormous sensitivity on initial conditions. Another question is, we're required to do this to follow the Dirac procedure of quantum mechanics because Dirac tells us actually we want to Poisson brackets between these, which means that we really have found them as functions of the initial data, which requires that we really, in closed form or some other way, inverted the Einstein equation. So there, and I'm saying this to separate issues again, I'm claiming that there's, we know what observables are in general relativity. We know, I'm going to maintain, at least for purposes of argument, we know what time is in general relativity. Those are already, we understand what those are. There's no issue about things being observable. But they're very far from the formalism that we're using to connect to quantum mechanics. Okay. And say, and this might, so there are some issues that arise in quantum mechanics that may be actually really issues about the difference between the solutions of the equations of motion and the Hamiltonian formula. They may really come in already at this level.
The spatial part, so loop quantum gravity does that. Mm-hmm. So you have proposals for what the gating dependent observables are.
Yes. Yes, so miraculously.
So but is there some deep meaning to that, or that there's something different about space and time?
Let's sneak up on that question. That's a very important question. And I think I embedded the discussion last time in a bit too much complexity, technical complexity, so I want to come back to it. I'm not going to come back to it in the next 5 minutes, but I want to come back to it. And that's a very key question. Okay, so now let me come to what the quantum mechanics wants us to do. And what the issues are. And as part of the, look, I think I'll be able to address, not answer, but address an aspect of your question. Okay. Let me remember that the generator of diffeomorphisms in the form of the script DV that I wrote down, remember I had two forms of it, and one of them was, it was the form of an integral over the Lie derivative with respect to the vector field of the connection times the conjugate momentum or electric field. And we had this one some two lectures ago. So let's just remember that. And then let me come back to the quantum theory. So Dirac says we find a kinematical state space, H kinematical, and I won't emphasize some of the technical issues that I emphasized before, but this carries some representation of the Q's and the P's or some other algebra of interest as commutators. That's, you know, I said more about precising, being precise about being a subalgebra, et cetera, but that's what that is. And then Dirac tells us, look for a way to turn the constraints into operators on the kinematical Hilbert space, and look for the kernel. Look for states that they annihilate, and put those states in the kernel together in some physical Hilbert space, which means give them a norm, either the same norm if the solutions are normalizable or not. Okay. Well, naively, let me be very naive without technical details. Okay. Naively, we talked about a certain representation psi of A. states which were functions of the gauge fields. And if I was really naive, now I feel a little bit badly doing this because I emphasize that loop quantum gravity does not do what I'm about to do. Loop quantum gravity is not a realization of the Poisson brackets of the A's and the E's. Okay, it's not that. But you might do that. And if you did that, so let's call this the naive kinematical Hilbert space. And if you did that, then what you would do for the A, for the E's, is you would represent them as functional derivative operators by A. That would be the naive thing to do. And if you did that, then you might choose for this constraint d of v, this constraint d of v would be the integral of L of v on A of d by d A. Okay? And now, and I can make sense of that. Now, that is naive, that needs a regularization prescription, but it's not too bad. And one can give that a regularization procedure. One can make this precise. Why? Because it's linear in the momentum. There's only one momentum for the functional derivative operator that needs to be defined. So I can then say the following. Okay. The integral of the spatial manifold LD of A, d psi by dA equals 0, if for all vector fields, psi of A is equal to psi of A plus the derivative of A by that vector field. That's a direct consequence. And this says that psi is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So this says, again, I'm being very naive, but this says that psi are functions on the A's mod the diffeomorphisms of the manifold, because the solutions are that the wave functions don't change if I move the fields around by diffeomorphisms. Okay. Now, in the loop representation, I was able to get to the same place. I was able to say the constraints annihilate the states if they depend on these graphs, but they don't depend on, if I move the graphs around by diffeomorphisms, they don't change. And I won't repeat that because I gave that demonstration before, but what's at the core of it is the fact that this is first order in the momenta means that I just get an operator like this, which is first, which is basically, I mean, if I was Abhay Ashtekar, I would have said this in a more elegant way, and I would say, look, this is a vector field on the configuration space. So all that I'm asking is that the states are functions on the configuration space, which are annihilated by a set of, which are constant on some set of vector fields. So there's some vector fields up there in the configuration space that are in one-to-one correspondence with the vector fields on the spatial manifold. And being diffeomorphism invariant means you don't change under those vector fields on the configuration space. Okay? So I can just solve the thing by eye. Okay. Now, let me emphasize I'm being naive. People in the ADM formalism for 30 or 40 years wrote down equations like that, and they turned out not to be turnable into real mathematical physics. So there are issues of, you know, does the statement from here to here really make sense, where you have to get real about regularization, limits, norms, and so forth. And when you do, certain things make sense and certain things don't make sense. While I'm here, The gauge constraint is the same story. If the gauge constraint is g of a gauge parameter living in SU2 is the integral of d of lambda ai eai integrating by parts. And therefore, as an operator on my naive kinematics of Hilbert space, this looks like the integral of d of lambda times d by dA. And this tells me that g of lambda for all lambda annihilates psi of A if psi of A is equal to psi of A plus the derivative of lambda. But that just again says that the functionals are gauge invariant. So again, being first order in the momenta, the interpretation is not impossible. I mean, the naive thing, I think Peter Bergman, Dirac, Higgs, a number of people by the end of the 1950s already understood. By the way, apparently it was the same Higgs who understood that the diffeomorphism constraint actually generated diffeomorphisms on the spatial manifold. At least that's the folklore that I hear. But now I need more blackboard, so let me come here. What's harder is at the same naive level, what am I going to do about turning the Hamiltonian constraint into an operator, because this involves products of momenta. So naively, this on psi of A, and I'll write the thing out. So first of all, you have a big operator ordering issue. There was a natural operator order, which is the one I used, which was the operator order. Says, let me be precise. I might here have put the d by dA over here and had to worry about terms where I took the derivative of this A. And that would have led to certain divergent infinite expressions. So it's nice to use an ordering that doesn't have any divergent infinite expressions in it. And it's also, you can see by the consequence of it, that if I use this ordering, there's a direct interpretation of what the constraint annihilating states means. It means that the states are diffeomorphism invariant or gauge invariant. So here is an issue of ordering. So let me just pick one. I don't know. D by D A A I epsilon I J K F J A B, this is at a point X, this is at a point X. And then I just chose one out of an infinite number of orderings. This thing, and then if I want the cosmological constant, minus lambda times this thing with two epsilons and d by d A, I just write that as, do you want me to write the whole thing up? Just for, let me do it just once. Here there's no ordering issue. Well, there is always an ordering issue. There's no obvious. There are some simple orderings. D by D A I, D by D J. And so I have something quadratic in functional derivatives and cubic in functional derivatives. Here is the cosmological constant. All this annihilating the states. So there's no obvious, this is no longer a vector field. It's a higher order functional differential operator. So there's no simple interpretation as it means that the states are constant along some vector field on the, configuration space. So there's no obvious meaning to it. By the way, it is not, except on solutions, generating diffeomorphisms of the space-time. That's a little side issue which I'll have to come to. So it's related to generating diffeomorphisms, but it's not on space-time, but it's not precisely. So there's an ordering issue. There are issues of infinities. There's issues of regularization. And finally, there are issues of normalizability of the solutions. That is, are they normalizable states? In the inner product of the naive Hilbert space, or do we have to invent another inner product? Okay. So this is very different. And this is the big equation that defines the dynamics of quantum cosmology. So this is what's usually called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I mean, it was originally written down in the metric variables, in the ADN variables, by probably Peter Berzin. And then it was written down by Bryce DeWitt, and then it was publicized by John Wheeler, et cetera. But this is the equation that we want to solve if we do quantum cosmology. And anytime you hear a talk about the wave function of the universe, whether it's the context of eternal inflation or loop quantum cosmology or anything else, you're dealing with model systems where the analog of this equation is studied. Okay. Questions? Okay.
Is it usually written with the ordering that you have?
No. It's never written with that ordering. But I happen to like that order. it is certainly been studied both with the D by DAs over here and the D by DAs over there. And in the loop representation, it looks significantly different than this. And much more is known about it in the loop representation quantum mechanically. But I don't want to bury you again in technical issues, so I'm not. Okay. I mean, what's important is that it's a higher differential operator, higher functional differential operator on the infinite dimensional configuration space seen naively, or something equivalent. Okay.
Am I wrong, or are there only three different ways of doing the ordering?
Well, there's always, you can always sneak in, you know, functions and one over functions.
Yeah, okay, but I mean, otherwise, like, because of the symmetry, there's only the question whether you need where you put the FAV.
Yes. Yeah. No, I agree. You know, naively, you can put one there and one there, or two here or two there. Now, let me tell you, roughly speaking, the good news and the bad news, okay, with respect to issues. I'll tell you part of the bad news first. If we don't know how to express any observable general relativity in terms of the canonical variables, A and E, classically, we certainly don't know how to express the quantum mechanics. Okay, I'll tell you the bad news first. Okay. So the bad news is that what an observable is now, from a canonical point of view, an observable quantum mechanically is an operator built out of the E's and A's or their loopy equivalents. It's built out of the operators I discussed last time, which has the property that it commutes with all the constraints, quantum mechanically. and is therefore an operator on the physical Hilbert space. And and that's a very difficult equation to solve. Even in loop quantum gravity, where it's much simpler, that is in the Ashtar-Kerr variables, where it's much simpler, because the Hamiltonian constraint is simple and polynomial than it is in the ADM variables. The possibly good news is that there exist orderings where there are explicit solutions. And this is actually results which were pre-loop quantum gravity when we were being very naive, but just to give you, to get you as puzzled as we were, let me tell you the explicit solutions. So one of the explicit class of solutions in the same Hilbert space we discussed, so last time we discussed Hilbert spaces where psi of A depended on some set of loops, and where the product over the loops of the trait of the t variables, the quantity of the loops, is a function of A. Okay, so we define this and possibly, you know, sums of such things. But let me, what I want, it's sufficient for me to talk about monomials. Okay? So let me tell you a very easy result. A very easy result is that if you order the constraints, so the Hamiltonian constraint is F d by dA, d by dA like that, A, B, A, B, I, J, K, epsilon, I, J, K, plus possibly the cosmological constant term or not, if you want it. Okay. Then C as an operator on such size of sets of loops equals zero is true if there are no intersections or kinks on the loops, period. They're an infinite set of solutions. And let me sketch the argument for that. Okay, so I've already, I don't need to come back to this because I have nothing to say about this quantum mechanically. The argument for that is that d by dA, AI, the operator, we've discussed this before, at a point t of the loop alpha and A, starts off integral ds around the loop, alpha dot A of s, delta 3 x alpha of s, and then there's the point where you embed the, to get the index I, the Pauli matrix, in a parallel transport around the loop, starting and ending at that point S. So this is an equation that I derived. If you do it twice, there's going to be a bunch of stuff. Okay, so these are at some point, x. Okay, so here's the loop. Here's the point. It's either on the loop or off the loop. If it's off the loop, it's zero. If it's on the loop,
the only structure there is a tangent vector there. Right? And
the spatial index here brings down the tangent vector.
So there'll be a lot of stuff, but there'll be a dot a dot b at that point p, at that point x. Has to be, there can't be anything else. There's no other vector in the problem. And these are multiplied by FAB, which is anti-symmetric. So it's zero. Okay, so that's a naive argument. You have to dress it up with regulators and limits and split the points apart and smear with test functions and take the limits where you bring the points together again. And after all that work, it's still zero. In fact, you can do that. That's been done in the literature several different ways with different representations, different regularizations, different smearing procedures. It's zero. And this is, yes?
Is your arrow supposed to go to the left then? You said if the constraint is zero, then there are no intersections. If my logic is right, then you mean that's the opposite.
I think if it's of that form, it's actually both ways. If I'm taking an odds for the state of that form,
yeah.
Then it's zero. No, you're right. If you're right, it goes the other way. It goes if there are no intersections or kinks, then it's zero.
Okay, fine. So it's not an equivalence. So
there are examples where there are intersections and kinks, then it's still zero.
Yeah, okay. That's good. Otherwise, I would have said your solution is out of the form.
Yes, but that there's actually an enormous amount of structure just in those solutions. There are. Because there's a lot of topological invariance in the linkings and the braidings and the knottings of non-intersecting loops. So the space of solutions that opens up is an infinite dimensional space of solutions with a lot of structure. Now, I agree with you, it's a bit boring. Okay. More to the point, these solutions are probably spurious. And I'll explain why they're probably spurious. And it's, again, it's an interesting thing. I'll explain why they're probably spurious. And then I think we're going to want to take a break. So this is the beginning of a long story, but an observable of interest is certainly the volume on the spatial slice. And that is equal to the integral on the spatial slice of the square root of the determinant of the feed metric with the index downstairs. And that turns out to be equal to the integral of the square root of the determinant of these E objects. I believe I have the power right. It won't matter much. But I believe I have the power right. And the determinant of E is a cube. Which is to say, the operator that represents it is just one more, what we just did, but with just one more A.
So therefore, I won't bother taking the square root, of course, is perilous. And so I won't take the square root. The determinant of E at a point x as an operator acting again on the same t. On the same state, let me just call it the same state, which is a function of a set of loops, labeled by a set of loops as a function of A, is zero for the same reason. That is, it's proportional to epsilon ABC, alpha dot A, alpha dot B, alpha dot C. So it's even more zero. And what I mean by even more zero is you regulate your point split, you worry about higher order terms, okay, and there's another zero there to get you. Okay. So it's even more immune to some escape from the regularization procedure. And in fact, the eigenstates of the volume operator with non-zero volume have interceptions. And so something that we learned after a lot of work and very painfully is to actually construct and diagonalize this volume operator, and its eigenstates are networks with intersections. In fact, they have to have at least four valent intersections to have a non-zero eigenvalue. In other words, the thing is so zero that three, even though there are three tangent vectors at a point to the three-valent intersection, that's not good enough. Yes?
But do they still satisfy the constraint of that normal ordering? Is that problem?
Yes. So this is an infinite dimensional space of solutions to the constraints, which all have zero volume.
Yeah, but I mean the ones which have non-zero volume.
Of the ones which have non-zero volume, some there within them, they generically do not satisfy the constraints.
Yes.
Because you can make, at an intersection point, you have different tangent vectors, so you can make an alpha dot A, say a beta dot, you know, at an intersection, you have two tangent vectors. So you can have FAB, alpha dot A, beta dot B, if this is loop alpha and this is loop beta, say. So generically, at intersections, they're not solutions.
But are there solutions with non-zero volume?
Yes. Yes. So there are infinite sets of those as well.
With this normal ordering, like being more non-trivial normal ordering, where you put the F on the
I don't know, because the construction of those, I really need the loop technology for. And I just don't know. There's a historical story here. We went to a certain distance at the naive level, and then we went to the loop variables that I discussed in order to be able to say precise things about regularization in the presence of different morphism in various states. And then there are precise results, but let me just say there are solutions to all the constraints at a full level of precision. And that work was finalized by Thomas Thiemann. There's a long series of works, and Thomas Thiemann's work was paramount in that. So there are states which are gauge invariant, spatially diffeomorphism invariant in the kernel of this, and have non-zero volume. And in fact, there's an infinite number of them, and very little is known about them, but there is a construction. And we're not done. If that was the end of the theory, we would be done. We're not done, but the technology allows that. Okay. So in spite of the issues there are, just to come back to the bad news and the good news, the good news is that there are solutions to the full set of constraints. And the bad news is that the problem of the observables appears very difficult. If the problem of the observables, and the third issue that appears, that is
difficult, and different people have different views about, is the issue of the normalizability, is the last issue of, when you find the solutions to the constraints, do you need to take them and put them in their own Hilbert space with their own norm? I believe the answer is yes, and I believe it hasn't been done. I should say not everybody in the field agrees with that. But if somebody wants to argue with me here, I'm happy to argue. One of the reasons it hasn't been done is that the condition that the inner product should satisfy is that physical observables, which are real classically, should be represented by Hermitian operators. And that becomes a condition on the inner product. That the inner product should be chosen such that a sufficient number of physical observables, which are real classically, are Hermitian. And if we do not have explicit constructions of physical observables, there's observables that map the space of solutions to the constraints to themselves, we can't directly make that test. So, so let me pause, let's pause here. And then what I'd like to do when we come back is talk about just really the open conceptual problem. I think this is enough of the technical development. If people want more of the technical development about the Hamiltonian constraint, I can give it, but all that I'm going to use for the rest of the course is the claim that there is an approach where there are solutions to the constraint. But given that the rest of the construction is not gone through anyway, I'm not going to be making big claims based on that. And you know, if I show you, maybe let me just put it this way: if I showed you one of the solutions to the constraint that's entirely worked out in Siemens form, it has the form of consider if you give me some arbitrary spin network or graphs or labels, okay, and I'll give you a series of spin networks, an infinite series of spin networks that differ from that one by making small local changes at the vertices. So where there's a node here, say a three-valent node, I would consider the graph we insert a triangle. And this will be the last thing that I say. It's worth so they have the form of psi, say, of an arbitrary graph with a triangle in it with some labels A, B, C, D, E, F, which are spins. Is some function of the labels A, B, C, D, E, F times the value of the wave function on the graph where the triangle has been removed. Okay. So the Hamiltonian constraint turns into a set of recursion relations of that form. And then you can argue that you can iterate if I give you the wave function on some graph with no triangles and no certain other structures, you can iterate. So that's great. That's a solution to the laws of the universe. You know, now do physics. No, I'm serious. That's the issue. Now do physics. Okay, there's no time. There's just the wheel of the Witt equation. There's no time. The solution to all the constraints. Okay. The observables are somehow buried in the combinatorics of those graphs. You know, to do something, you know, what's the non-Gaussianity of the cosmic microwave background or something? Right. And we don't know what to do. So, but we have the solutions of the constraints. Okay, let's pause for 15 minutes. Here.